and I want to try and focus on spiritual death and renunciation, and link that with, I think last week there was a talk on going for refuge, is that right? So I want to link the path with going for refuge and spiritual death and renunciation. It's nice to see so many people here come here for a talk on renunciation. Obviously a very popular subject. Okay, so the path of human life, of spiritual life, which and the reason I don't like the term spiritual is because what we call a spiritual life is the truly human life. It's not as if you've got this human life and then you've got this spiritual life. Human life is what we're about, isn't it? It's about deepening this life of ours. There's not something else that's called spiritual. But the problem of the word, it sounds a bit exotic, it sounds a bit over-earnest, it sounds a bit humorless to my ears. It sounds like something that somebody else might do, not me. I come from the West Midlands. Nobody does anything spiritual there. So what we call the spiritual life is really the truly human life. It's about this being human, and it's about discovering what that means more and more. And part of that is realising right from the onset that we don't realise how deep this humanity of ours goes. We've got all kinds of views about what being human means, but we don't really understand how deep being human goes. We think we do, but we don't. And sometimes you're confronted by that, aren't you, when, for instance, a parent dies. When my father died so many years ago now, I was already a Buddhist, but I was really struck by the fact that I didn't know what had happened. I had no idea what had happened. All I knew is I wouldn't be able to talk to him anymore. And I was sorry that I couldn't just say the word dad anymore. I couldn't say, oh, dad, and have that simple exchange with him. That's all I knew that I couldn't have anymore. But as to what death was, I had no idea. I've never experienced not knowing something as strongly. I didn't know that he was going to be carrying on after death. I didn't know that he'd stopped. I didn't know that that was at the end. All of my categories, including my Buddhist categories of rebirth and so on, I had no idea. I just did not know what happened. And really what that is that we do not know what being human is. We don't know what death is, but we don't know what life is. We just walk around thinking we do. And we all kind of talk as if we do. But we don't actually know what our life is, never mind our death. So what we call spiritual life, you see that it's a it's trying to get to grips with this mystery of being human. It's trying to see our situation more clearly. Part of that seeing more clearly is realising that we don't see it clearly. Part of clarity is realising that we don't know what we are. And many of us would do much better to not know. We're too clever by half. My art teacher used to say they should have the tops of their heads cut off, which was her way of saying they're too clever. We need to realise that we don't know, and then what we call clumsily spiritual life, what we call more accurately Dharma life, is about exploring what we don't know. Much more exciting, isn't it? Exploring what we don't know. And then this figure on the shrine represents, embodies, what we can be. That this being human has this in it somewhere. Deeply buried, perhaps, so foreign to our general everyday sense of ourselves that we don't recognise it. We think it's this gold, slightly Indian or foreign perhaps to some people's eyes figure. We don't realise really that it's whatever this figure is trying to portray is actually in our experience, that our humanity, like you know, a beach that goes deeper and deeper into the ocean. Our humanity goes as deep as that, as marvellous as that, as majestical as that. Which is already an interesting vision, that the Dharma vision, the Buddhist vision, again, even Buddhist is a bit tricky word, is primarily a positive one. That at the deeper we go, the closer we get to that. We don't get closer to sin or evil or badness or anything like that. The deeper we go, we get closer to that, whatever that figure represents for us. So we don't know what this being human is. We don't know what death is. We know it's going to happen. We don't know when it's going to happen. And we've no idea when it's going to happen. So we don't know what death is, and we don't know what our life is, not really. We just go around telling ourselves stuff and telling each other stuff, but really we don't know. It's only at moments that you really see that, and one of those moments is death. So we're trying to explore this being human with this view somewhere that we're going somewhere inadequately embodied by this figure, if you mean. And this figure is, it's a bit like that, is what this figure is saying. It feels a bit like this, where we're going. Yeah. So we're starting off with a sense of real sort of humility. We really don't know much. I mean, I don't know much about anything. I mean, I might be a sort of, I might be a bit thick, but I really, as I got older, I just think, I really don't know much about anything. You know, it's not so much I've got holes in my education, I've got education in my holes. Little tiny, sort of, tiny little islands is too big, little tiny, you know, little flotillas of bits of knowledge, all broken off. So I know this bit, but I can't remember what that connects with. And I know this about blackbirds. I just discovered that it's male blackbirds that come back to the same nest. But that's about it. You know, if this isn't a lecture on blackbirds, it would be very short. So in that mystery, in that context of human life and death, our job surely, although we don't really know what it means, is to live a fully human life. And the first great phase of living a fully human life is becoming integrated. Yeah. You could just say that what we call spiritual life is just an extension of growing up. When you're a child and then you're an adult, then you're a Buddha. Simple as that. Yeah. So the first great stage of growing up, the first great stage of being a truly human being is integrating, becoming more and more integrated. The place that we notice this, I won't talk too much about these earlier stages because it's not what I want to concentrate on, but the place that we notice this is in prapuncha. So prapuncha is this word that probably many of you know by now. We're trying to say it so often that it has to be put in the dictionary. It means mental proliferation, that's what it literally means. Rumination, fantasy, planning, remembering, rehearsing, rehashing, telling stories in our mind. Self is largely a story that we tell ourselves, a story that we're addicted to, that we compel to repeat. So what prapuncha shows us is that we're not integrated. Prapuncha is both a symptom of disintegration and the cause of it. So it's like every nano moment, our mind is becoming a different person. We fantasize about an argument and become an angry person. We fantasize about success and become a pop star, whatever it is. There's no pop anymore, is it? Anyway. Our mind, telling stories to ourselves, creates different selves that we tell stories about. Poor me, marvellous me, victimised me, victimising me. We tell ourselves stories and our psyche kind of splits along the tributaries of our stories. We're beguiled by the people that we say to ourselves in our mind. Yeah? One of the results of this is that we don't really have very much energy. Yeah, so much of our energy is sort of dribbling away into different selves that are in conflict with each other. So there's a self to now, as you're listening to this talk, that wants to practice spiritual life, whatever that is, practice a fully human life, and then there's a self on Saturday night that wants to watch a DVD and perhaps drink too much in their club or something. Different people who want different things. Do you see what I mean? If I suddenly said, by the way, it's Saturday night, half of you would leave, because you're a different person who wants a different thing on a Saturday night. Self is time located, isn't it? You can be a different person Monday morning. So the first great task of spiritual life is to become more and more integrated, to become one person. And what that does is it unifies your energies and gives you energy. All the people that I look up to, and I'm fortunate enough to have many people around me that I do look up to, have got this released sense of energy. We had Subhuti here just recently, and I mean, it's like sitting next to a nuclear reactor sometimes. He's just got so much energy, intellectual energy, emotional energy, physical energy. He's so alive, so very alive, yeah? And that's a symptom of integration, being alive like that. Again, the other thing that I think is a symptom of integration is a kind of gravitas, a kind of psychic weight that people have. And I notice this not only in the Buddhists I look up to, but in the poets that I've come to know. Some of them I've come to know quite well. And what I've noticed with all of them that I've known, come to know well, in whose poetry I admire, they have a kind of weightiness about them. The metaphor I've been using in the book that I'm writing is like a weighty orange. You know, a ripe orange is heavier than an unripe orange. So integration ripens you in that way, so you get weightier. Yeah? So the great way of cultivating mindfulness... Can we edit that out? Unfortunately, we can't. So that will be there. Anyway, never mind. The main way the great sort of road to integration is mindfulness, the practice of mindfulness, by which I primarily mean, at least at this stage, noticing your mind going off in prepuncture into those disintegrating stories that we get hypnotized by. It's interesting, our mind is like a used car salesman sometimes, isn't it? Selling us a story about who we are, about what happened, about what's going to happen in the future. And very often we buy it. We buy the story that we tell ourselves in our mind. Just to be a bit personal, as I'm going to do, I had a little bit of that tonight. So I've just done this weekend retreat in which I was talking quite a lot. I'm trying to write this book, which is turning out to be much harder work than I expected, and much longer. And I got to the class tonight, frankly, feeling a bit grumpy. You know, I just thought, I can't believe I'm doing it again. I don't want to go to a class. I was writing at 8 this morning and write all the way up till 1 or something like that. I didn't really want to come. I hope that's all right. You know what it's like. I bet you're like that sometimes. It's not just me. I didn't really want to come. And then we had this meeting, the team meeting. We had a team meeting before the class, and suddenly lots of my friends were there. So I started thinking, well, actually, it's not so bad, it's so nice. I started to sort of be concerned for someone like that. One of them on my team has just arrived, having driven for a long way, and I thought, I must remember to tell him to lie down, not to set up. And as soon as I had that little tiny bit of concern for somebody else, rather than my story about, you know, I'm working so hard, you know, martyr me now. It's terribly bad form, but it's so easy to get into that look how hard I'm working thing. It's terribly tedious. Anyway, it's sort of a story that we tell ourselves so often. I'm so busy. It's sort of a self-important story, really. But as soon as I started to think about other people, I stopped doing my, yes, but I'm so important and I can't believe I'm having to teach again, all that silly enough. It wasn't that bad, but it was a little bit bad. And what I noticed is that by the end of the team meeting, my mood had completely changed. And then there's some people here that I haven't seen for quite a long time. I was really pleased to see them. And I had a bit of chat with a few people. Before I knew it, by the time we started, I felt right as rain. I didn't feel my story about how busy I was and how I didn't want to do any more teaching. Da, da, da. I think, oh, it's great, this is great, well, this is what I want to do. Do you see what I mean? Really simple example, but it's so easy to be sold the stories you tell yourself. I'm really busy, people don't understand me, I don't know, whatever it is. And all you need to do is act in a different way, and your story changes. So the first thing to do is to notice ourselves in prapuncha, in this kind of storytelling, beguiled by the stories we tell, and we just keep stepping out of that. And we step out of that into our body. That's what I was trying to do in the meditation. We just keep noticing that's what we're doing. We're telling ourselves a story about who we are. So how about we just actually experience ourselves in the body just now? Each time we do that is a moment of integration. Yeah? And that's really, at least simply, what mindfulness is about. It's a core practice. You never stop doing it, you always have to do it. You always need to do it. But integration is more mysterious than it sounds. So far it sounds fairly straightforward, I hope. You can practice it immediately. But like most things that sound straightforward, they're much more profound. So as you go on with this practice of integration, the issue that comes up is, what are you integrating around? Do you see what I mean? The metaphor of integration, you have to integrate around something. I think this is one of the reasons why the lotus is so significant. That instead of thinking, this leads to that, leads to this, you could think of it just being like a lotus opening. And one of the petals is integration, one of the petals is positive emotion, one of the petals is spiritual death. But what's in the middle? What's the stamen? Yeah. In the mandala, you know, which is a sort of, you've probably seen Tibetan sand mandalas, where it's basically a ground plan of a temple. It doesn't look like that, but that's basically what it is. And you get the Buddha figure sitting in the middle. And the temple is designed around that central figure. So at a deeper level, you see how integration implies something in the centre of your life, around which you pattern your life, around which you arrange the contents of your life. You'll only be able to be integrated up to a point without that deeper focus, that central focus. And what's mystical, I think, about that central focus, it needs to be big enough to contain everything in you. If you put work at the middle of that of your mandala, you'll end up serving your work, and your work will destroy you. If you put money in the centre of your mandala, you'll never feel like you have enough money. If you put love at the centre of your mandala, you'll always feel you're not loved enough. It seems to me that to integrate deeply, we need in the centre of our life something that goes beyond our life. Not like a stick in the ground, a single idea, and I don't mean even a Buddhist idea. I mean some deeper sense of what being human is about, what being here is about. Even if that's a mystery, that you're trying to organise your life around some central principle around which you can make sense of yourself. So that's really what the language of going for refuge, which we had last week, is all about. It's trying to put what's most valuable at the heart of your life. An ideal, a transcending ideal, embodied in this case by the Buddha. The teachings of that ideal, especially in ethical teachings, kindness, love, generosity, truthfulness, courage, and so on. And a sense of community, a sense of vivid interaction with other people, that other people matter. They matter intrinsically, not because you want them to matter, but because they matter to you. Yeah? That's what Going for Refuge is trying to get at, is that you put a transcending ideal at the life of ideal at the centre of your life, and then you integrate your life around that. So when I was young, I tried to put art in the centre of my life, and then that didn't work. I wanted to, because art was, in my life, art was attached to being a success, to being in a gallery, to having a first time show, to being interviewed on the South Bank show, the whole caboodle. And of course it didn't deliver that, so the centre of my life broke, if you see what I mean. It was only after coming here and practicing the Dharma that I started to put, and I still need to continue to put and really put the Dharma at the centre of my life. Really, mostly, it's just me at the centre of my life. Little old me, what I want and what I don't want. At my best, I put the Dharma at the centre of my life, and then I can arrange my art, my poems, my whatever I'm doing, my teaching, my communication, all around that central principle. So that's the first stage of integration, which is full enough, yeah? Difficult enough. Having integrated ourselves to some degree, the second great stage of life is what I've called, what Bhante's called, emotional positivity. Not a great name, positive emotion, the stage of positive emotion. Recently I've been calling it the stage of emotional strength. I think it might be, in some ways, a bit better. Stage of emotional strength. Really, the best, most accurate way of talking about this stage is the stage of Kusala Karma, which is actually a Sanskrit and a Pali word, but hey, none of you are scholars, so I can get away with it. I have to slightly pronounce it differently otherwise. Kusala Karma, so Kusala means skillful, and karma means action, it simply means action. So when people say, it's your karma, they've got it wrong. Karma just is your action, but it's your actions of body, speech and mind. Yeah? So, having integrated yourself to some degree, and integration is endless, you act well. You do things that change your mind, in other words. That on the basis of acting in body, speech and mind, acting positively, you change your consciousness. And you see how my little story about tonight is a little tiny microcosm of that. Had I carried on in the state I was in, I probably, you know, had I not been here, I probably would have done more work and teaching. And I bet that story would have just carried, work of my book, that story would have carried on. Like, this is so hard, I've got so much to do, I've got all these emails waiting for me, it's too much. That story can just carry on and on. But because I came here tonight and met you in friendship with you, my mind starts to change. I start to get a different mind. Because I start to think, oh, a friend of mine is tired and I must remember to just suggest something that might help him. I go out of myself a little tiny bit, not a big deal, a little tiny bit, and then my mind changes. Because somebody comes and says they're pleased to see me, my mind changes. Yeah. So this is a great matter of Kusala Karma, is that we start to realise that we change our life every moment by how we act in our body, with our body, with our thoughts and with our emotions. That you can be fulfilled, but it means changing how you behave. And I just did it just a little bit tonight. And I just need to keep on remembering to do that. It's easy enough, just at my moment. But, you know, before I know it, if I'm not careful after the class, I get back, oh, I'm so tired. Oh, no, no, and I've got another day tomorrow. You know, and off I go, if I'm not careful, back into my story. Just as you get beguiled by your stories. You get in a good state for a bit, and then you think, what was I worrying about? Oh, yes. And you go back to it. Or you think, who was I hating? Aha, I remember. And you go back, and okay, off we go again. Who was to blame? It was my mother, you know, and we go back to that story about how we weren't treated well and so on. So I was saying this at the weekend, that the primary thing about this is that we need some kind of faith. So how we behave, and remember in Buddhism that's to do with how you behave in your mind, primarily in a way, because everything else comes out of your mind. How you behave in your mind changes the consciousness you have. Without that kind of faith, we'll think we can just buy happiness, we can buy positivity, we can think we can download it. Or we'll think, you know, we'll have some kind of theory about how we get to be happy. We need a bigger house, we need a new boyfriend or a new girlfriend, we need more money, we need to go over traumas of our past. We'll have some kind of theory about how to be happy. What the Buddha is saying is, we need to cultivate this faith that how I act in my mind, how I act when I speak to you, how I act when I go up and do I do the washing up or not, how I act, whether I get to bed early enough rather than spending the rest of this evening on doing my emails, even that changes your mind so much, doesn't it? All you need to do to change your mind is go to bed late. I mean, we are like children. If we go to bed late, guess what? We're really grumpy in the morning. And then we start to blame somebody for that. You know, it's those really simple things. Yeah? So those are the first two great stages of the spiritual life. There's integration, becoming one person. The primary manifestation of that is that we take full responsibility for our life. We actually are a grown-up. This is our life. And we can ruin it if we want to. That's up to us. Or we can flourish it if we want to. That's up to us. But this is our life. People don't really make me feel too busy. That's a story I tell. Yeah? A story that I've told since I was a child, when I wasn't doing anything. I remember when Alex, my niece, was 3, I went to pick her up from nursery, and Gary, her father, went to have a snooze. And she said, "Why is Daddy having a sleep?" I said, "Well, he's had a busy day." She said, "I've had a busy day." I said, "Oh, you've been in the nursery with like all those games." She was already, "Well, I've had a busy day, you know, it's not just him. I'm going to the swings. Don't see why, you know, I think it's probably for him." It's weird, because I partly got it from my parents, and my parents were self-employed. They created this coach company, and they were always working. They always felt busy. And it's true, and they said to themselves a lot they felt busy, and they passed. I picked it up from them to some degree. We need to take responsibility for that. It's a story I like to tell myself. And I like to tell myself, even though it gets me feeling unhappy. I'm addicted to it, effectively. But if I change my behaviour, I can start to change my story. I can start to change my consciousness. Consciousness will appear in a different way. So that's our first stage of integration. Then you move on to positive emotion, and you deepen that. You try to make it so that your energy is fully, radiantly positive. Most of us, what we've got really is a sort of shortage of positive emotion. So these first two stages are what I said in the book, that what I am writing at the moment, they represent your fit mind. The first great task of being a fully human being, being a truly human being, is to develop a fit mind. And a fit mind is primarily a mind that's integrated, a person who takes full responsibility for themselves, who is living through their body, not just through the stories in the mind, who is living more and more fully and richly, and who is making a contribution to life. Another way of talking about positive emotion, which sounds a bit jazzy, is just making a contribution to life. Yeah? That's what a grown-up human being is. You don't need to come to a Buddhist centre to develop that. I've met people who've never meditated, have never done any of this stuff, who I think have got very strong elements of positive emotion and integration. But that's the first thing that we need to cultivate. If we want to go further, then we start to say, okay folks, it's Buddhism time. There's nothing to sign up for, but if you want to go further than that, you need more than merely human teachings, although the word merely is wrong, because there isn't a merely human. No one feels merely human. You'll need you'll be confronted by yourself. And this next stage, which is the stage of spiritual death, which I'm hyphenating really with the stage of spiritual rebirth. Again, it's not, when I say you need to be a Buddhist, I don't mean, aha, I need to go and get this floppy disk, or if nobody has them anymore, do they? Anyway, I need to get this
USB.
Thank you. USB pen, or Bluetooth, which I still don't know, frankly, what it is. Anyway, we need to have this, and I need to get this Buddhisty thing, and sort of, you know, put that in, and I'm a Buddhist. It's not like that at all. What Buddhism is doing is saying, well, you need to just notice your experience. So you start to notice, if you look at your experience, that, gosh, how much of my time I'm just chattering in my mind. And I'm often doing that in a way that just means I'm not noticing my life. And actually, a lot of it's rubbish. And the bit that isn't rubbish is, like, toxic. It's actually, just to be really cheery, there's a few nice bits. But, you know, a lot of it's not even recyclable, is it, really? So you start to notice that, and then you start to notice that if I keep on bringing my attention to my body, I get away from that a bit. I create a bit more space from that. So you just notice that out of your direct experience. Then you notice that, oh, you know, Madhavani was talking about, you know, being a bit thinking of other people. Well, I'm going to try that. So you do that the next day, and you notice that as soon as you start to do that, you feel happier. You think, oh, it's true. You know, my consciousness is arising in a different way. And you see that that's what the Buddha is saying. You just notice your experience. You notice that if I act like this, my consciousness opens. As soon as I get bad tempered, as soon as I start to criticize somebody in my mind and tell them all their faults, my consciousness shrinks. I feel unhappy again. What Buddhism's saying, what the Buddha's saying is, you need to really notice that. Now, if you carry on noticing that, you start to notice, gosh, I'm really much more aware of my body. I'm like living in my body. It's really pleasant. I feel completely, this is my life. And when I meet people, I'm just much happier to meet them. I feel pleased to see people much more quickly. People can be difficult, don't get me wrong, but by golly, but I don't react so habitually. I don't need to tell myself that kind of angry story about them. I just sort of say, oh, but hang on, is that true then, what you just said? You know, I find a more creative way of managing that. I don't become the sort of little nice person, Mr. or Miss Nice person. I just sort of say, no, I don't think that's true, but I don't enter into the reaction. I can be quite strong and firm with people, but I don't get into a big boiling thing in my mind. And then that would carry on and carry on. Then you start to feel, that's all great, but something's still getting in the way. It's not, I feel happy, I feel good, I feel in more harmonious relationship with the world. Something's getting in the way. And what you start to feel is that it's me getting in the way. But even after all this integration and positive emotion, there's something getting in the way of life. So you might notice that you go to a concert and you're in this integrated state of mind. And you're at this concert and you're really enjoying the music and it's really touching you. But every so often a little voice says, oh, this is really good. And as soon as you say that, you push yourself right away from the music. And then you say, don't do that. I was really good a minute ago. And that pushes you a bit further away from the music. As soon as you talk to yourself, you say, here's a nice bit that's coming up, and you're no longer listening to it. You go, stop saying that, I'm doing it again. It's like Finding Nemo, you can't get out of it. I just saw that, that's really good. Or, you know, you're doing a meditation and you're watching your breath, and you're feeling the breath in the body, you're integrating around the breath, you're feeling really positive about it, and then you think, this is going really well. You're out of it. As soon as you think this is going really well, you're back in your everyday mind. You think, damn. And you think, okay, next time I'm not going to do it. You're still going to... But a part of you has got your great big hand behind your back waiting. This is going really well. Do you see what I mean? So you start to notice in your direct experience that you get in the way of life, finally. Not because you're bad, not because anything. Just that life keeps opening up to you and you want to just live, but you keep on saying something about it. You see something, a beautiful landscape, and you're moved by it, and you think, oh, I'm having a moving experience, and you're right out of the landscape. Yeah, we keep on standing in front of our life. So you see how self has to die. The only way for life to be lived fully, which is surely what we want, is to live fully, for this life of ours to just course through us, to burn us up, to dissolve into life. Self has to die. Self is getting in the way. It's something that we keep on having to go on about, even when we don't want to go on about it. Even when, actually, it'd be much more fun not to go on about it. We have to say, yeah, but there's me still. So spiritual death is about letting self die. And as soon as you let self die, to whatever degree you do that, something is reborn. You can't say what that something is, but it looks a bit like that. It feels a bit like that. A new perspective, something you hadn't dreamed up, not some new theory you've got, including some new Buddhist theory. Some new way of perceiving life is reborn in that moment. And you've had moments of this already, probably. I remember having it on my this retreat I was on it when I was ordained. And sorry to say, I got into a real conflict with a friend of mine, a very close friend of mine. At the early part of the meditation, I got in the retreat, it was a 4-month retreat, I got into a conflict with him, particularly in my mind. I was sort of criticising him in my mind. And I remember thinking, I'm going to have to cut off the friendship. I can't be a friend of this guy anymore. I'm just going to have to kind of cut it. And I remember feeling, oh God, I'm going to have to, you know, destroy the friendship. And I just died into thinking, I just can't do it. I can't be a friend of this. You know, I just kept getting annoyed. You know what it's like. You keep getting annoyed by somebody, and you think, don't get annoyed, don't get annoyed. And the next time you get annoyed straight away. And I just thought, I can't do it. I can't be a friend. I just can't do it. I can't do it. And I, because I'd been on retreat for a long time, so I was very integrated, I was very emotionally positive, I just let this feeling of, I can't do it, I can't be a friend, I can't do friendship, I ain't got it. I let that feeling completely arise, and I died into it. And as soon as I died into it, I seemed to become a different kind of creature. It was as if afterwards I was made of glass. I don't think I've ever had experience quite like it. I really thought I was in meditation, and I really felt, I didn't think it, because it was too deep for that, but I became completely transparent and completely pure, like I was made of snow or something, or crystal. Some completely new mind arose. I could never have imagined it. I didn't think it would be good to have this kind of mind that's a bit like crystal. You know, I'd like to have like snowy experience just now. I didn't have any thoughts about what kind of state of mind arise. All that I did is I died into thinking, I can't do it. I just can't do it, folks. Yeah? I died into that. I let go into that. And then something else appeared. Yeah? A new way of being appeared. Yeah? So this is spiritual death. So I want to just finish by saying three things about spiritual death. So spiritual death is both the culminate, spiritual death hyphenated with spiritual rebirth, because just in that little story there's death, and it's like the downward part of the swing, the downward bit, the spiritual death is the downward part of the seesaw, spiritual rebirth is the upward. I must put that in the book, that's a good one. you die and something's reborn. You can't really separate them. It's like trying to separate a torch from its light. You can kind of cognitively separate them, but you can't experientially. Yeah? As soon as there's death, there's rebirth. So that spiritual death is both an aspect of your spiritual life from the very beginning, and it's the culmination of spiritual life. Spiritual death, spiritual rebirth together in the seesaw. Yeah? So as an aspect of your spiritual life, practice of spiritual death is to be unselfish. Yeah. Really dead simple. Sangharakshita was asked, how do you know, Bhante was asked, how do you know if you made spiritual progress? He said, you're a little bit less selfish. That's how you know. And you know, somebody I think had come from Spain to interview him, and that was their big question, how do you know if you made spiritual progress? He said, you're a little bit less selfish. Is that it? Yeah. I can't believe it. That's it. You're a little bit less selfish. Yeah? So the ongoing day-to-day practice of spiritual death is being a little bit less selfish. In tiny, tiny moments all the time. Yeah? And each time it's a death. You make a meal for somebody, you put it on plates, and you think, I want the bigger pot, but I'm going to... Or you've got one chocolate leg, you know, those clichés. But you die to selfishness in a minute way, but sometimes even that's quite a task. You know, that moment when you're relaxing and feeling at ease and you see somebody doing some work and lifting something, and you sort of think, they probably need me to help. And you think, I wish I hadn't seen. You know, you wish you hadn't noticed it. And you get this thought, go and help them, shh, go. You know, just comfortable. And then that's a death, isn't it? You have to think, okay, I'm just going to be a bit unselfish. Yeah. That is a kind of bedrock practice of spiritual death. There's no other practice of spiritual death without that. Otherwise, it's just fancy ideas after that. Unless you're becoming less selfish, you're not practicing any kind of spiritual life, whatever that dreadful term means. But of course, that's the fundamental, but you can think of it in two other ways. So you can think, if you think of that as a provisional spiritual death, and by provisional I simply mean something that everyone can do. You don't need to be a Buddhist to do that. In fact, what makes somebody truly human is to the degree to which they're unselfish. That's what growing up means. You can't be unselfish as a child. That doesn't work for children. You need a sort of consciousness before you can be thought of being unselfish or selfish. Growing up means growing into being unselfish. Yeah? So, if that's provisional spiritual death that we all need to do, you can then have the opposite of that, which is real spiritual death. Real spiritual death, you can't practice. You can't practice it. Yeah, it's not a practice. It's what happens to you. Real spiritual death is seeing through the delusion of self. I tried to lead us a little bit into a meditation just now, trying to see through that even in something like sound that we can hear, as soon as we label it, locate it, try and work out the source of it, you see, that's me doing that. It isn't in the sound. There's nothing spooky about Buddhism. It's just saying, it's not in the sound, those ideas. That's you doing that. So that self is trying to die at that level. So there is just sound. Yeah. So real spiritual death, you can't do. It's a culmination of spiritual life. It's unwilled. You do the job, as it were, of spiritual life, which is integration and positive emotion. It's the job of being unselfish. And some new state of mind arises. The example I have in my own life when I was younger was when I was painting. So sometimes, you know, you'd paint away, painting. You get really frustrated with it. And then sometimes, something else comes through. Suddenly you're painting without willing anymore, without forethought. Suddenly you're painting. Suddenly it's like it's doing itself, and you're not in charge anymore. Something comes through you from beyond you. Yeah? So spiritual death and spiritual rebirth would be like being in that state all the time. Everyone you meet, every time you get to the tube, you don't think about it, you don't plan, you don't think, what do I think about this? You just spontaneously respond to what needs responding to. Yeah? So that's real spiritual death. You can't practice it. It's not something you can make into a practice. But between those two things, provisional spiritual death, which is our daily practice of being unselfish, and real spiritual death, which is the culmination of the path, what the culmination of being fully human, truly human, between that is effective spiritual death. Yeah? An effective spiritual death is commitment to real spiritual death. Yeah, that's what it is. That's what effective spiritual death is, that you really have now got to the point where you see that self needs to die. You're really seeing that now, that this life of mine needs me to die to it, and I see that so deeply now that I'm going to commit my life to that. And you see, as soon as you do that, you're saying no to all sorts of things. I'm not going to be a concert pianist anymore, probably. I'm not going to... I'm going to gather my life around this quest to die. This is me, strange though that sounds. I'm going to pattern my life around that. That's what's most important in life. That's the essential matter of my human life. And I'm going to commit myself to do that, and that means not doing this stuff, and it means now doing that stuff. It means not staying up really late at night so that I can meditate in the morning. It means not having a work life where I can't make friends because I'm too busy. It means all kinds of things. It means I need to get on retreat regularly, very, very regularly. It means I need to spend time alone. It means I need to study the Dharma. I need to change my way of thinking. it's the most serious point in spiritual and the spiritual path is the decision to commit yourself to real spiritual death and real spiritual rebirth. Yeah. And you see how it's a going forth on one hand, a going forth especially from worldly attitudes, which are attitudes based around self-identity, basically. We have a belief of a really existing self, and we build a world that supports that. And spiritual death means letting, consciously deciding to let go of that. How one works that out in detail, one cannot teach you. You need to make friends with people who have done it, and work together at working out how you do that. Because some things need to go, some things need to stay, and some things need to be transformed. And it's the patterning of your life changes, but it's too difficult to tell. I can't give a public talk about how that needs to change, because it will change for each of you uniquely. Yeah. But some things will need to go, some things will need to stay and go further, some things will need to be transformed. But there is definitely a going forth, a going forth from a worldly outlook, from getting and spending, from instant gratification, from a gratification culture, from ideas that keep locking you into me as I think I am. And don't misunderstand how radical that is. The people I look up to most are people I feel, you can even feel that in them, that there's something about them that's radical, that doesn't fit in, that isn't just part of everyday life, that's not smoothly fitting in with conventional life. Yeah? So that's the going forth aspect of it, and then there's the going for refuge to spiritual death and spiritual rebirth, which is going for refuge to the Buddha, because he, this figure, not actually even he by this point in any meaningful sense, but this figure represents you at your deepest, you as you really need to be, your final expression of yourself. Being becoming a Buddha it's the same, growing up to being a Buddha is just the same as an acorn growing up to be an oak tree. It's the expression of your nature. It's what being human wants to do. Like a flower wants to become a flower, go from a group, little seed to a root to a plant to a leaf to a flower, we human beings want to become a Buddha. We're given it already. We don't need to even call it that if you don't want to, but we want, and that's what that figure represents. So in our system here at Sri Ratna, what that means is that commitment to spiritual death and spiritual rebirth is the moment you ask for ordination. That's when you decide to ask for ordination, is when you decide, in this context at least, that that's what your life is about. And that's what you want your life to be about for the rest of your life. That you devote yourself to spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. And that means actually devoting yourself to the unknown. And as I was saying in my little advert about the winter retreat, it's devoting yourself to keep on remembering that that's what you've devoted yourself to. Which is one of the reasons why here I am on a Monday evening teaching you, is to keep remembering, I'm 27 years ago, I think, some time ago, 25 years ago perhaps, I decided to commit myself to spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. Which is also commitment to higher levels of integration. It's commitment to greater degrees of emotional positivity. But that's what I decided to do. And that's what I need to keep remembering that I decided to do. To the degree to which I'm doing that, I'm going to be useful to you. To the degree to which I'm not doing that, I'm not going to be useful to you. It'll just be about me again. You can see I can be quite a charming person in the right mood. But you see how, so what? If that's all I've got, a few bits of charm, the odd joke, a bit of stuff about contemporary poetry, it's going to run out fairly quickly. Yeah? To the degree to which I can help you is the degree to which I have focused my life on what this figure represents. Yeah? To the degree I've done that, I can't focus on this aim of my life and still want to be a pop star or still want all the other stuff, be successful, have status, all those kind of nonsense. I need to renounce that. I need to turn away from that to turn towards this. Simple as that, really. Yeah. So that's what I've tried to do tonight. I've tried to talk about going for refuge and renunciation, but I've really wanted to put that in this much bigger picture of living a truly human life. What is it that we're doing just now with our life? Can we find a way of committing ourselves to a truly human life? And in this context, that means ordination. And that's completely up to you if someone decides to do that. But you see how, first of all, there needs to be a level of integration. Otherwise, you can't keep up with your commitment. You're not integrated enough to follow through. There needs to be enough emotional positivity. Otherwise, you could be doing it because there's peer pressure to do it, because you want to be liked by people who sit at the front of the room, like me, because all sorts of weird reasons that are coming out of lack of emotional positivity. Do you see what I mean? So you need enough of that to think, yes, I want to do this for no good reason, but it's what I want to do. It's no weird religious reasons. They're not allowed. It's just like someone who decides, like there's a moment in Auden's life, W.H. Auden's life, when he was in his teens, he was in Oxford, he was going with a walk with a friend, and they were talking about religion, and Auden was being terribly rude to his friend who was very religious. And his friend decided, oh God, I just don't want to argue about God anymore. So he thought, I better change the subject. So he said to Auden, remember he was just a teenager, he said, have you ever written any poems? And he said, this guy said, it was literally just to change the subject. And as soon as he was asked that, Auden knew that, no, he hadn't, but that's what his life was going to be about. He said he never could quite understand it, but in that moment, he just thought, no, but yes, that's what I'm doing. That is why you've named what I am. And then he wrote poems every day, pretty much, until he died as an old man. And some of them are some of the greatest modern poems ever written. So he didn't think, there's no religious thing in that, he just thought, that's what my life is about. Yeah. So commitment needs to be as much as possible like that. So I wanted to put going for refuge in the context of the five great stages of spiritual life: integration, positive emotion, spiritual death, spiritual rebirth. I haven't mentioned the other one, but perhaps we'll come back to that later. We better end there.